Hello, I'm Malcolm Bernstein. It is the New Yorker Hour, and today we're reading from the issue of September 30th, 2019. The Desperate Plight Behind Darkness at Noon. Arthur Kessler's novel of the Moscow trials laid bare the gulf between communist ideals and the reality they produced. On December 1st, 1934, Sergei Kirov, the head of the Communist Party in Leningrad, was shot and killed in the hallway outside his office. The assassin, an unemployed man who had been expelled from the party and bore a grudge against its leadership, was apprehended on the spot, but the case still raised questions. How did the killer get his pistol? Who had called off the bodyguards who usually surrounded Kirov at all times? Today, most historians agree that it was Joseph Stalin himself who ordered the murder in order to eliminate a potential rival. But the official investigation came to quite different conclusions. During the next 4 years, it metastasized into a conspiracy hunt that claimed to expose shocking villainy at the highest levels of Russia's government, military, and industry. In a series of trials that were publicized around the world, some of the oldest and most trusted Bolshevik leaders, men who, with Lenin, had led the Russian Revolution, were accused of being traitors, supposedly acting on orders from Stalin's exiled rival, Leon Trotsky. They had plotted to murder Stalin, to hand Soviet territory over to Nazi Germany, and to restore capitalism in Russia. Their alleged methods included not just assassinations, but also industrial sabotage or wrecking, even putting ground glass in the nation's butter supply. At the conclusion of the trial, two veteran party leaders, Lev Kamenev and Grigory Zinoviev, the state prosecutor general, Andrei Vyshinsky, denounced the defendants with florid Stalinist rhetoric. These mad dogs of capitalism tried to tear limb from limb the best of our Soviet land. I demand that these dogs gone mad should be shot, every one of them. There was never any doubt about the verdict or the sentence, and the party leaders who were condemned in what came to be known as the Moscow trials were only the most prominent of the victims. Stalin's Great Purge of 1936 to 1938 ultimately took the lives of 1 million Soviet citizens and sent millions more to the gulag. By the late 1930s, Western intellectuals who sympathized with communism had already proved themselves capable of accepting a great deal of killing in the name of the cause. Such fellow travelers usually justified Stalinism's crimes as the necessary price of building a socialist future and of defending it against a hostile capitalist world. Walter Duranty, the New York Times correspondent in Moscow, excused the 3 million famine deaths that were caused by the push to collectivize Soviet agriculture, writing that, quote, to put it brutally, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs, close quote. The Moscow trials, however, presented a different sort of challenge to the communist faith. It was one thing to unleash the power of the state against kulaks, the wealthy peasants who were key villains in Soviet mythology. But how could it be that old Bolsheviks, who had until the day before yesterday been the rulers of Soviet Union, were secret counter-revolutionaries? On the other hand, if the charges were false, why did the defendants confess? Zinoviev, who had been a member of the first Politburo in 1917 and the head of the Comintern, said, "My defective Bolshevism became transformed into anti-Bolshevism, and through Trotskyism I arrived at fascism." Kamenev concluded his statement by addressing his children. "No matter what my sentence will be, I in advance consider it just. Don't look back. Go forward with the Soviet people. Follow Stalin." Did such men simply give in to prolonged interrogation, the so-called conveyor, whereby prisoners were questioned for days on end by a team of agents working in shifts? or to outright torture? Were they trying to protect their wives and children, who were effectively Stalin's hostages? Or did they feel that, in some obscure way, they deserved punishment for crimes they hadn't committed? Here was a problem for a psychologist, or better, for a novelist, one who understood communism from the inside and knew what it was like to be a political prisoner. That novelist was Arthur Koestler, and the book that the Moscow trials inspired him to write was Darkness at Noon, which became one of the most important political novels of the 20th century. Telling the story of a veteran Bolshevik who is awaiting trial for treason, the book originally appeared in December 1940, just 2 years after the event it drew on, and became a worldwide phenomenon. In America, it was a bestseller in a Book of the Month Club selection, and was soon adapted into a hit Broadway play. When it appeared in France in the spring of 1945, it sold 500,000 copies. Some observers credited Darkness at Noon with tipping the balance against the communists in the French elections of 1946. Now, Scribner has published a new translation of the book by Philip Bohm, based on the original German manuscript, which was discovered in a Swiss archive in 2015 after being lost for 75 years. The story of how it disappeared in the first place gives a vivid sense of the dislocated world from which the novel emerged. Koestler began writing Darkness at Noon, under its original title, The Vicious Circle, early in 1939, in France, where he had lived as a stateless refugee ever since Hitler came to power in Germany 6 years before. When the Second World War broke out that September, the French government took the opportunity to sweep up such immigrants, especially those who, like Koestler, had Communist Party connections, and put them into internment camps. From October 1939 to January 1940, Koestler had to abandon work on the novel while he was a prisoner at a camp in southwestern France. When he was released, after string pulling by some highly placed literary and political friends, he returned to Paris and quickly finished the book. As Koestler worked, his English girlfriend, Daphne Hardy, sat in the same room producing an English translation, and, at the beginning of May, both manuscripts were mailed out, the English version to a publisher in London, and the German version to a publisher in neutral Switzerland. 10 days later, the Germans invaded France and swiftly conquered the country. Koestler, who was a Jew, a communist, and a refugee, knew that if he fell into Nazi hands, he would certainly be killed, and he and Hardy embarked on a headlong dash for the unoccupied southern zone of the country, separating along the way. Hardy, a British citizen, made it back to London fairly easily, but Koestler underwent a months-long odyssey, during which he joined and then quit the French Foreign Legion, twice attempted suicide, once with morphine, once with cyanide. Miraculously, neither worked. And he finally smuggled himself via Morocco and Portugal to England, where he was promptly arrested once again. While he was in transit, Hardy had been corresponding with the London publisher, which, despite some reservations, had accepted the novel for publication. When the publisher objected to Koestler's original title, it was Hardy who, unable to contact Koestler, decided on calling it Darkness at Noon. The phrase was an allusion to Job, chapter 5, verse 14. They meet with darkness in the daytime and grope in the noonday as in the night. A description of both the moral conundrums facing the novel's protagonist and the desperate plight of Koestler himself. The German manuscript, meanwhile, was presumed to have been lost in the chaos of the war, so the English translation of the novel became, in effect, the original, from which all subsequent translations were made, including one back into German. The new edition is the first to return to Koestler's German text and aims to replace Hardy's version, which was the hasty work of an inexperienced translator. Though clearly it was good enough to have secured the novel's global reputation. This new Darkness at Noon arrives in a very different world from that which greeted the original, and one important difference has to do with Kessler's reputation. In 1940, he was 35 and little known in the English-speaking world. He had been a successful journalist in Berlin and a Communist Party activist in Paris, but Darkness at Noon was his first published novel. It transformed him from a penniless refugee into a wealthy and famous man, and was also the best book he would ever write. It was followed in the 40s by an important book of essays, The Yogi and the Commissar, and several thought-provoking but less consequential novels of politics and ideas, including Arrival and Departure, which reckoned with Freudianism, and Thieves in the Night, about Jewish settlers in Palestine. But after that, Kessler's reputation took a fairly steep dive as he turned from fiction to pop scientific works that earned the scorn of actual scientists, especially when he began to embrace ESP and other paranormal phenomena. By the time Kessler died in 1983 in a double suicide with his wife Cynthia after he was given a diagnosis of terminal leukemia, he had already seemed to belong to history. And the dive turned into an irrecoverable plummet after the publication, in the past two decades, of biographies by Michael Scammell and David Cesarini, which exposed him as an egotistical monster with a lifelong pattern of abusing women emotionally and physically. At least one woman accused Kessler of rape, but many others describe behavior that today would certainly be classified as sexual abuse. Simone de Beauvoir said that he kept aggressively pushing and pushing her to sleep with him until she gave in. She said, "I really detested him, that arrogant fool." If Kessler's biography raises one barrier to his reception, a changed political climate raises another. Soviet communism in its heyday served many people around the world as a secular religion. Today, although Marxist ideas and the label socialist have been resurgent on the left, the enormous influence once exerted by communism now seems a distant phenomenon. To its adherents, communism was not just a party identification, but a complete theory of life and history, which dictated both personal and political morality. And it was the conflict between that morality and ordinary moral instincts, which condemned things like lying and killing, which the party often demanded, that provided the dramatic focus of Darkness at Noon. The novel reminds us of a time when literature was felt to be urgently political, when the critic Lionel Trilling could speak of the dark and bloody crossroads where literature and politics meet. This gave Kessler, like his contemporaries Jean-Paul Sartre, George Orwell, and Albert Camus, a kind of authority that no novelist approaches today. Darkness at Noon is certainly dated in the sense that an effort of imagination is needed to enter into its time and place. But its central theme will probably always seem timely, because every political creed must eventually face the question of whether noble ends can justify evil means. As Kessler saw, this problem reached its purest form in communism, because its avowed aim was the noblest of all, the permanent abolition of social injustice throughout the world. If this could be achieved, what price would be too high? Maybe 1 million or 10 million people would die today, but if billions would be happy tomorrow, wasn't that worth it? A communist revolutionary, Kessler writes, is forever damned to do what he loathes the most, become a butcher in order to stamp out butchery, sacrifice lambs so lambs will no longer be sacrificed. Kessler's protagonist, Nikolai Salmanovich Rubashov, is one such righteous butcher, now facing his turn on the chopping block. The figure Rubashov especially evokes is Nikolai Bukharin, a veteran theorist of revolution who was the most famous of the defendants in the Moscow trials. Like all the other defendants, Bukharin ended up pleading guilty, and the new edition of Darkness at Noon usefully reproduces a speech that he gave at his trial. "I consider myself responsible for a grave and monstrous crime against the socialist fatherland and the whole international proletariat," he said. Yet there was ambiguity in that "consider myself responsible," for Bukharin insisted that he was unaware of any of the specific plots of sabotage and assassination with which he had been charged. His crime, he seemed to be saying, was not actual, but mental, even metaphysical. Perhaps he was pleading guilty only because he knew that it was the last service he could render to the party which he had served for so long. For when you ask yourself, if you must die, what are you dying for? An absolutely black vacuity suddenly rises before you with startling vividness, Bukharin said in the courtroom. He went on, there was nothing to die for if one wanted to die unrepentant. Repentance, even false repentance, could give propaganda value to what would otherwise be a meaningless death. In Darkness at Noon, Kessler inserts a version of these words into a speech that Rubashov gives at his trial. But although Rubashov dies as a loyal party member, by the end of the book he has lost his certainty that the things he did in the party's service were justified. Indeed, Kessler suggests that the Moscow defendants may have pleaded guilty as a form of clandestine atonement for crimes they really did commit at the party's command. They were all guilty, just not of those particular deeds to which they were confessing, Kessler writes. Much of the power of the book comes from its journalistic immediacy and the authenticity of its details. Rubashov's jailers, for instance, work on his nerves by leading a prisoner who is his friend past his cell on the way to execution. Robert Conquest, in his groundbreaking history, The Great Terror, published in 1968, confirmed that this was a standard technique in Soviet prisons. Kessler explains the code that political prisoners developed in order to carry out conversations by tapping on the walls of their cells. And he knew that the most common way of executing prisoners was to shoot them in the back of the head when they weren't expecting it, which is how Rubashov dies in the final pages of the novel. But the real plot of Darkness at Noon is almost entirely internal. It lies in Rubashov's evolving realization of his guilt and his loss of belief in the infallible justice of communism. Early in the book, a flashback shows Rubashov on a mission in Nazi Germany in 1933, just after Hitler seized power and banned the Communist Party. In a thriller-like scene, Rubashov covertly meets with a German communist named Richard, who pours out his grief to this representative of the socialist fatherland. His comrades have been murdered. He is living in hiding, and he is losing faith in the cause. Rather than sympathize with him or promise help, Rubashov tells Richard that he is being expelled from the party because he has dared to distribute pamphlets that, as he coldly says, contained wordings that the party considers politically inadmissible. By the end of the scene, it's clear that Richard has been marked for death. "The party cannot be wrong," Rubashov says. "You and I make mistakes, but not the party. Anyone who disagrees with the party's dictates is on the wrong side of history, and so deserves to be eliminated." The Moscow trials, Kessler suggests, were just the latest example of a tendency towards self-cannibalism that had been there from the start. It is no accident, to use a phrase favored by communist writers of the time, that Kessler found the party's treatment of foreign comrades to be the most conspicuous example of its injustice, since he had spent most of the 30s as one of those comrades. Born into a Jewish family in Hungary in 1905, Kessler had already lived several professional and ideological lives by the time he joined the party in 1931. As a teenager, he had been a committed Zionist who moved to Palestine to work on an agricultural settlement. Quickly realizing that this austere existence was not for him, Kessler transformed himself into a journalist, working as a stringer for German newspapers. After 2 years, he returned to Europe, and by the end of the 20s, he had a precociously successful career in Berlin, working as an editor and writer for one of Germany's biggest liberal dailies. In the essay that he contributed to The God That Failed, published in 1949, a collection of 6 memoirs by ex-communist writers, Kessler recalled how conditions in Weimar Germany turned him into a communist. He wrote, "Germany lived in a state of latent civil war, and if one wasn't prepared to be swept along as a passive victim by the approaching hurricane, it became imperative to take sides. If the struggle in the future was between Nazism and communism, then communism was the only possible choice." But Kessler emphasized that he did not become a communist by process of elimination. Rather, he compared the experience to a religious conversion. "The whole universe falls into pattern like the stray pieces of a jigsaw puzzle," he wrote. "There is now an answer to every question." For the next 7 years, communism was at the center of Kessler's life and work. "I served the Communist Party for 7 years, the same length of time as Jacob tended Laban's sheep to win Rachel his daughter," he wrote in The God That Failed. In the biblical story, Jacob finds out at the end of that time that he's been tricked and given the wrong bride. In 1932, after losing his highly paid job because he claimed his employers learned that he had joined the party, Kessler made a pilgrimage to the Soviet Union, where he spent 18 months traveling around in order to write a propagandistic book praising the Soviet experiment. By the time he left Russia in 1933, Hitler was in power and he couldn't return to Germany. Instead, he went to France, where he worked for a series of party-funded publications and agencies until 1938. Throughout this period, Kessler later wrote, he was well aware of the gulf between communist ideals and the reality they produced. He had seen the victims of famine in Ukraine, and he had gone along with the party's ruthless imposition of the official line. But he still felt the only way to improve the party was from within. Indeed, he was willing to risk his life for it. In 1937, Kessler went to report on the Spanish Civil War for the News Chronicle, a British daily, knowing that if he was captured by Franco's nationalists, his life would be in danger. In February, he was caught in the city of Malaga as it fell to Franco's forces and taken prisoners. For the next 3 months, he lived in a cell not unlike Rubishov's, as his fellow prisoners were executed, and he waited for his turn. But, because he'd been on an assignment for an English newspaper, the British government and press took an interest. The public attention meant that Kessler was spared. In the end, he was released as part of a prisoner exchange. This experience, which Kessler wrote about in his memoir, Dialogue with Death, could have strengthened his communist convictions. After all, he had been imprisoned as a Rojo, a Red. Instead, his imprisonment awakened a new sense of the preciousness of freedom. "Strangely enough," he wrote, "I feel that I have never been so free as I was then." This was an existentialist kind of freedom, cold and clear, the last possession of someone with nothing left to lose. Once he was released, Kessler found it impossible to retreat back into the intellectual orthodoxy of party life. Events in Russia, including the news that three of his closest friends had been arrested in Stalin's purge, only confirmed his disillusionment. In 1938, the year he resigned from the party, Kessler gave a speech to an audience of refugee intellectuals in Paris in which he affirmed that a harmful truth is better than a useful lie, and that no movement, party, or person can claim the privilege of infallibility. His listeners, he remembered, were split in their reactions. The non-communist half of the audience applauded. The communist half sat in heavy silence, most of them with folded arms. Darkness at Noon, which Kessler began writing the following year in the south of France, was his attempt to work through the intellectual and emotional reasons for breaking with the party. Rubishov is a better communist than Kessler ever was, and the purity of Rubishov's faith allows the novel to lay bare its contradictions. How did communism, with its dream of a perfectly just society, result in Stalinism with its paranoia, persecution, incompetence, and cruelty? Our principles were all correct, but our results were all wrong, Rubishov muses. We brought you the truth, and in our mouths it sounded like a lie. Kessler's reckoning with communism is very different from Orwell's vision in 1984, which was published 9 years later. In Orwell's dystopia, INGSOC, English socialism, is not really an ideology at all, just a tissue of lies and a tool for mass hypnosis. The party's leader, O'Brien, famously tells Winston Smith, after his arrest, that the core of its appeal is pure sadism, the pleasure of exercising total power over another. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. Stalinism, for Orwell, dressed up this power worship in a lot of meaningless doctrine that people learned to repeat without thinking about it, what the novel calls duck speak. Orwell's book, in other words, is relatively indifferent to the intellectual content of communism, which may explain why it is now more popular than Kessler's. Kessler takes dialectics seriously. Marx claimed to have shown that history was a process of continual conflict moving toward a final redemption, when the proletariat would cast off its chains and the exploitation of humanity would disappear. For Kessler, it was the belief in the historical inevitability of this outcome that enabled the Bolsheviks to act with such ruthlessness. Acts that ordinary morality judged to be wrong would be justified as right and necessary once a classless society had been established. Whoever proves right in the end must first be and do wrong, Rubishov says. But as he sits in his cell, he comes to realize the immensity of this moral gamble. For if the revolution fails and a just society doesn't come into being, then the revolutionary's crimes will remain merely that. Rubishov says it is only after the fact that we learn who was right to begin with. In the meantime, we act on credit, in the hope of being absolved by history. The deferral of responsibility for one's own actions to an outside agency such as history is what Sartre, in his existential writings of the time, defined as bad faith. And Rubishov's awakening, like Kessler's in his Spanish cell, is a kind of existential crisis, a sudden recognition of the necessity of individual judgment. The Communist Party, Kessler writes, has a tendency to shy away from using the first person singular, since it reckons in masses, not individual. The I is, for the party, nothing more than the grammatical fiction, an illusion that had to be overcome in order to justify justice for many. But Ruvashov's experience in prison convinces him that the I, for all its fragility, is of infinite value because it is the ultimate source and basis of morality. To the party, the fact that the I partakes of infinity is what makes it useless for purposes of logic. Infinity was a politically suspect quantity, Kessler writes. But if you remove the irrational dimension from human existence, call it subjectivity, or, in religious terms, the soul, it turns out that you can no longer understand how people will feel and act. As Ruvashov comes to see, for communism there was a mistake in the calculation. The equation did not add up. If the Soviet Union was, as its defenders often say, an experiment, for Kessler it was an experiment gone wrong, in which the experimenters have flayed the test person alive and left him facing history with exposed tissue, muscles, and tendons. It is Ruvashov's long-standing failure to understand this truth, not his alleged crimes against the state, that finally leads him to embrace his guilt. Why hadn't the prosecutor accused Ruvashov, what about infinity? He could have not have known how to answer, and here, right here, was the true source of his guilt. Could there be any greater? At its core, Darkness at Noon treats Stalinism as a philosophical problem. But was it? Doubtless most of the crimes committed in its name stemmed from more ordinary motives like greed, fear, and hatred, just as the defenders of the Moscow trials confessed largely out of terror and exhaustion rather than as penitence for existential guilt. Still, Kessler saw that in the modern world it took the ruthlessness of an idea to marshal ordinary human cruelty into an irresistible force. It is this distrust of the tyrannical power of reason, even when it considers itself most righteous and humane, that makes Darkness at Noon a subversive book even today. It is still hard for people who consider themselves enlightened to accept Ruvashov's hard-won conclusion. Perhaps thinking everything through to the end was not a healthy thing to do. This by Adam Kirsch. He's a poet, critic, and the author of, most recently, the global novel, Writing in the 21st Century. Next, Alan Bigelow's Solar Cooking Revolution. Late one recent morning, Alan Bigelow set up 7 solar thermal cooking devices in the front yard of his house in Nyack, New York. Sunshine was pouring down like slot machine jackpots. One of the 7 cookers cost essentially nothing and consisted of linked cardboard panels covered with aluminum foil, which reflected the sunlight to a central point on which sat a pot of jasmine rice. Another was a metal box with silvery surfaces that unfolded upward to catch the sun and aim it at a pot of chicken and tomato stew. A high-end solar cooker, about $500 retail, which involved a large parabolic dish and a cooking surface like a burner on an electric stove, had already become hot enough to get a pan of stir-fry shrimp in turmeric sauce. Bigelow is the science director of Solar Cookers International, a nonprofit that promotes solar cooking around the world. He talks with a slight Texas drawl, because that's where his family is from, and where he's got his Ph.D. in physics. But he grew up all over. His father was in the Foreign Service. Bigelow raises his eyebrows when he smiles, as if he has a wonderful present waiting for you in the next room. 4 months ago, he demonstrated solar cookers at a refugee camp in northern Kenya. More recently, he's talked to delegates at the UN. Mary Frank, the artist, is his friend and fellow solar cooking proselyte. She has been a volunteer at SCI for more than 2 decades. Frank had come down from her studio in Woodstock and brought the chicken and shrimp. They were making the solar lunch for themselves and a man from New Jersey. About 3 billion people around the world cook on open fires, Bigelow said, giving the parabolic cooker a nudge to keep it aligned with the sun. Frank said, and all that smoke is bad for the planet, of course, but the fires are also terrible for the women and girls who have to tend them, breathing in the smoke, getting burns and lung ailments, risking being raped or even killed on their increasingly long journeys to find biomass to burn, wood and dung mainly. She started taking the shrimp out of the pan, and the man from New Jersey quickly ate one. Chicken and tomato with rice followed, done perfectly. Cicadas in the trees did their impressions of various electrical appliances. Hydrangea bushes in the yard burst into even more elaborate bloom, and the incoming sunlight, at a rate of 1,000 watts per square meter, transformed into culinary heat, seemed to hum. Bigelow opened a map on the patio table. It showed the average yearly sunlight around the globe, with the less sunny places, northern Russia and Seattle, in limp pastel shades of yellow and blue, and the sunniest places of vigorous sunburn red. Those included most of sub-Saharan Africa and a lot of India. Billions of people live in these parts of the world, and many of them are considered the last mile, beyond the last mile of road, he said, sweeping his finger across the red. For them, solar cooking can reduce deforestation and soil erosion, and they can also use the cookers to pasteurize water where there's a problem finding a potable supply. One of the 7 cookers had been baking a cake, whose cozy winter aroma filled the golden green summer day. Frank served slices on a solar simmered fruit compote. The scene now shifts to the Bronx. Bigelow is about to give a talk to solar cooking fans in an SCI board member's home. Rose Bazile, originally from Haiti, who started the world's first college-level solar cooking class there, says to a New Jersey man, "In Haiti, I even use my solar cooker on the roof of my car. I have a Toyota RAV4, and I put sweet potatoes, squash, plantain, hamburger. Nothing that requires water because the bumps will splash it out. Into my cooker, and I tie it to the roof. Then I set out from Port-au-Prince to Côte d'Ivoire, a 3-hour drive, and by the time I'm about halfway, the food is done. I stop at a picnic table, take the cooler from the roof, and eat my lunch under a tree. Solar cooking is perfect for Haiti because fuel can be hard to find and many of our hillsides are completely stripped of trees. But we have sun in abundance." Bigelow put in, "There are at least 14,000 solar cookers already in Haiti, and we hope that number will grow by thousands and thousands more." He raised his eyebrows and beamed. This report by Ian Fraser, a staff reporter at The New Yorker, and most recently having published Hogs Wild, Selected Reporting Pieces. Let's talk some politics. The floodgates open on Trump. This by David Remnick. Shortly after 8 on the morning of September 30th, the President of the United States, making maximal use of his executive time, wielded his smartphone to issue a legal threat against the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. It is worth reading the missive from @RealDonaldTrump in full. Quote, Representative Adam Schiff illegally made a fake and terrible statement, pretended it to be mine as the most important part of my call to the Ukraine president, and read it aloud to Congress and the American people. It bore no relationship to what I said on the call. Arrest for treason? Question mark. Were the collective nerve endings of the electorate not so frayed and numb by now, we might be even more alive to the ugliness of this message from the White House. One of the consequences of the Trump presidency is the way that it constantly diminishes our expectations of anything other than hideous rhetoric and action. But there are those who are intensely aware of the political consequences of such a threat. Sources close to Schiff told The New Yorker on Monday that Democrats in Congress are deeply worried about the president using Twitter to incite violence and direct it at specific members. The threat to Schiff via Twitter came just a few days after the president, speaking at the United States mission to the United Nations, said that whoever provided information to the whistleblower about his 25th of July telephone call with the president of Ukraine was, quote, close to a spy. Trump went on to wax nostalgic about how spies were dealt with, quote, in the old days, close quote, with the death penalty, in other words. As soon as I heard that, I thought, he has the soul and mind of an authoritarian, said Nicholas Burns, a former high-ranking diplomat who has served in Republican and Democratic administrations. What other president in American history would say that? The off-handed encouragement of vengeance, even violence, is hardly new or unusual for Trump. Here are some selections from the Anthology of Incitement. At a February 2016 rally in Iowa, if you see somebody getting ready to throw a tomato, knock the crap out of them, would you? I promise you, I'll pay the legal fees. At a rally in Oklahoma. In the good old days, they'd rip them out of that seat so fast. But today, everybody's politically correct. Our country's going to hell with being politically correct. In Wilmington, North Carolina, Trump issued a winking endorsement of violence against his opponent, Hillary Clinton, who he had said might go so far as to appoint judges who favor gun control laws. He said, if she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know. More than 3 years later, Trump has intensified the search into his singular obsession, Hillary Clinton's emails. Details seem to emerge almost hourly about the extent of his corruption and subterfuge. On Monday, the Times reported that Trump behaved with the Australian Foreign Minister Scott Morrison, much as he had with the Ukrainian leader, pressing Morrison in a recent telephone call against Attorney General William Barr and the Justice Department in an attempt to undermine the findings of the Mueller report. The Washington Post then added to the miserable picture reporting that Barr had held private meetings overseas with various foreign intelligence officials to get them to investigate and ultimately help to discredit the findings of the CIA and other U.S. intelligence agencies about Russian interference in the last presidential election. The onset of an impeachment inquiry in the House of Representatives, an initiative that is gathering increased public support during an election season, is sure to elicit more and increasingly lurid threats of retribution from the president. As a result, anxiety throughout the federal government has deepened. This is a time of real fear inside the State Department, Burns, a former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, told me. Diplomats throughout the Foreign Service became particularly concerned when, in May, the administration recalled the ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, widely considered a deeply knowledgeable, experienced, and nonpartisan diplomat. Yovanovitch had wound up on the wrong side of the Trump circle, including Rudolph Giuliani and Donald Trump Jr., who referred to her on Twitter as a joker, according to the government account of his call with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Trump said ominously that Yovanovitch was going to go through some things. Burns, who is now an informal and unpaid advisor to Joe Biden on foreign policy issues, told me that Trump's disregard of democratic norms has reached such a point of crisis that the floodgates are now going to open and the people inside the White House and the federal government may now come forward to the inspector generals inside the system. This president has overturned much of what made us great, and I think that is appalling to career people. Senator Chris Murphy, a Democrat from Connecticut, told me that the administration is propagating a long-held conspiracy theory to justify its behavior. He said, "My understanding is that Trump, Giuliani, and others in the administration believe that there is a deep state conspiracy in the State Department against the president and that Masha Yovanovitch was part of this. Her recall from Kiev," he said, "was a consequence of that conspiracy theory." The deep state conspiracy theory is hardly confined to the West Wing. Murphy went on, "I hear this too from my Republican Senate colleagues. There's a belief that there is a group in every corner of the government that's out to get Trump. These are really morally centered people who find him deeply distasteful, and it is required of them to raise the questions of corruption if they see it. The Trump administration sees that as a conspiracy." Murphy is hardly revealing a deeply held Republican secret. On Fox News, Stephen Miller, Trump's senior policy advisor, told Chris Wallace that the whistleblower was a deep state operative, pure and simple. The whistleblower's report, he added, was little more than a 7-page Nancy Drew novel. Wallace pushed back against these talking points, calling Ms. Miller's answers obfuscation. Then Wallace played a video of Joseph McGuire, the acting director of the National Intelligence, testifying before the House Intelligence Committee last week that the whistleblower and the inspector general who brought the report forward had acted by the book and followed the law. Among the most pressing questions being discussed now in Washington is how long Republican members of Congress and former White House officials will continue to show fealty to Trump. I'm still stunned that Republicans are circling the wagons in the way that they are, Murphy said. They may just decide to ride this out. It may be that they are so entwined around the president, they are so stuck to him with superglue, that they can never come unbound. The testimony of the whistleblower could be a dramatic chapter in this unfolding drama. But who else might come forward to testify? One person might be Yovanovitch, who has so far steered clear of speaking publicly about her dismissal and deeply unjust fate at the hands of the administration. Others might include Kurt Volker, who just resigned his post as special representative for Ukraine, lawyers in the White House counsel's office, and other high-ranking officials, including former cabinet secretaries, national security advisors, and chiefs of staff, who may finally see no point in reserving their sour descriptions of Trump for deep background sessions with reporters and authors. They may soon decide it's time to speak in their own names for the sake of history, decency, and their reputations. And finally, what level of perfidy in the White House, what permutation of public opinion will it take before Mitch McConnell decides he can no longer continue his cynical marriage to Trump? It can be assumed that the president will go on using the weapons he learned at the feet of Roy Cohen, constant attack, ruthless threats, the shameless propagation of conspiracy theories. John Dean, whose testimony helped rip the scales against Richard Nixon in the Watergate affair, told me that the character of Donald Trump ensures that his story could get farly uglier than it already is. Dean said, even Nixon would be offended by this effort to use foreign assistance for a very personal political reason, which is a very corrupting undertaking. I don't think Trump has any morals or shame. He will do anything to get reelected. It's just the way Trump thinks. He doesn't care. He will destroy anybody. I find him a deeply troubling character. When he first went in, I worried that his ignorance would get us in trouble. Now it's his disposition that I find most troubling of all. This by David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker since 1998. Here's something a little lighter in politics, the art of the political cameo. Bernie Sanders is a curmudgeon in an 80s drama, Cory Booker reaches across the aisle in Parks and Recreation, and Bill de Blasio won't shut up on The Good Wife. Some people believe that in 1968, Richard Nixon beat Hubert Humphrey in 4 seconds by looking into a camera and asking, "Sock it to me?" on Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. If cameos can really move voters, then it would seem that Donald Trump has an advantage going into 2020. Trump has made around 24 cameos, appearing in Sex and the City when he flirts with Samantha. Home Alone 2, he tells Macaulay Culkin where the lobby is. The Little Rascals, in the role of Waldo's dad. And The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Carlton says, it's the Donald. He favors a certain kind of role, characters who get to kiss attractive women or give sage business advice. Waldo's dad is just a rich guy who has a weird relationship with his kids. His solo line, "Waldo, you're the best son money can buy." Some of the Democratic candidates have been slightly more selective. Senator Elizabeth Warren has only one TV credit, playing herself in Alpha House, a political comedy series created by Gary Trudeau. Warren's scene takes place at a book signing, where she inscribes a book for a fellow senator, played by John Goodman, promising that she's not going to run for president. Mayor Bill de Blasio has been on 3 TV shows, The Simpsons, The Good Wife, and Horace and Pete, a 2016 web series made by his friend Louis C.K. On The Simpsons, the joke is that the mayor is tall. He lifts up Grandpa Simpson and says, "From my shoulders you can see Rhode Island." On The Good Wife, the joke is that he's annoying. The mayor won't stop talking. On Horace and Pete, he's both tall, you're big as shit, and annoying. Of the NYPD, he says, "It's your NYPD. It's all our NYPD." Michael Price, who wrote the Simpsons episode, coached the mayor remotely from L.A. as de Blasio recorded his part in New York studio. A deep laugh, kind of like Jolly Green Giants. A big "ho, ho, ho," Price said. It required several takes. Senator Cory Booker recently lent his voice to a short film called Boundless, directed by the actress Rosario Dawson, who's also his girlfriend. He plays Kevin's dad, a disembodied voice from off-screen who yells, "Kevin, your friends are here." The film is available on YouTube. Comments have been disabled. Booker's other 2 roles, cameos on Being Mary Jane, a BET drama, and the NBC sitcom Parks and Recreation, are more method. In the first, Booker is suckered into a gotcha moment by a news anchor, but he recovers and ends by making a point about the black incarceration rate. In the Parks and Rec episode, we which aired in 2015, he shows his willingness to reach across the aisle. On the same day that Booker's cameo was shot, the Parks and Recreation film crew did scenes with Vice President Joe Biden, whom Leslie Knope, the show's protagonist, played by Amy Poehler, has a crush on, and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. She felt just like the kind of politician Leslie would get excited about, Mike Schur, one of the creators of the show, said. Last month, Gillibrand dropped out of the 2020 race. Biden is currently leading in the polls. Biden was surprisingly easy to get. We asked if the vice president would be interested in doing a cameo of himself, and it was very instantly like, yes, absolutely, Schur said. Since then, Biden has appeared on one other show, Law & Order SVU, where he gives a speech about rape kits. In Parks and Rec, Booker has a scene with Orrin Hatch about the 85-year-old Republican senator from Utah, now retired. We came up with this crazy bit, Schur said, that the two of them had a Polynesian folk band they played together in, and while Leslie was talking to them about her proposal to increase the national parks budget, they were also really excited about getting her to watch them perform. Booker and Hatch happily did take after take. They both improvised a couple of times, Schur said. If 4 seconds on TV can sway an election, what can a movie scene accomplish? Only Bernie Sanders would know. In 1988, the Vermont senator, then mayor of Burlington, played himself getting egged on Halloween in Sweetheart's Dance, a drama about two small-town couples, Susan Sarandon and Don Johnson, and Jeff Daniels and Elizabeth Perkins. A reviewer on IMDb called the film a must-see for couples with fading relationships. 11 years later, he was in another film, My Ex-Girlfriend's Wedding Reception, starring Debbie Gibson, the pop star. Sanders plays Rabbi Manny Shevitz. Martin Gigi, who wrote, directed, and starred in the film, grew up in Vermont. He used to have a band, and one time at a club gig in the 70s, he spotted Sanders boogieing away. In the early 90s, he turned on C-SPAN and saw Sanders, by now a congressman, giving a speech. Bernie's delivery, Gigi said, it just struck me. It reminded me of a rabbi. Gigi got to work on a script. 3 years later, they filmed at a Holiday Inn Express near Lake Champlain in Vermont. Sanders came dressed in a blue suit and a red tie. The costumer said, you look perfect. Don't change a thing. Sanders, all business, pointed out some typos in the script. And he brought his own yarmulke, he said. That was a detail I hadn't put in. As the rabbi, Sanders gives a rambling speech, touching on the Brooklyn Dodgers leaving for Los Angeles and that free agency crap. He nailed it in one take, Gigi said. And it was so darn funny that everyone on the set wanted to see it again. So we did a close-up. And then he nailed it again. This is by Tyler Foggett, an editor of the Talk of the Town section of The New Yorker. And that is all we have time for today. I'm Malcolm Bernstein. This has been The New Yorker Hour, and I will be back again with you next week. Until then, bye-bye.